This is an ABC podcast.
The English car designer responsible for creating the Mini once quipped that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. But across the Middle East, the camel is seen as a creature of great beauty and significance. There are camel beauty contests, with owners resorting to Botox and false eyelashes to help their camel win the crown. Camels can sell for millions of dollars and are treated in state-of-the-art veterinary hospitals. The situation here is very different. Australia has the largest population of feral camels in the world, and many landholders see them as a pest. But some farmers are seeing opportunity when they look into those big brown eyes, farming camels for milk, meat, and who knows, maybe beauty contests one day. Those camels, of course, need vets. And that's where my guest today, Dr. Margie Bale, comes in. Hi, Margie.
Hello, Sarah.
Are there many vets like you in Australia that specialise in camels?
Certainly not many that admit to it. I'm not that I know of. There's certainly a large group of mixed animal practitioners that would see a camel here or there as part of their daily work. But I'm, as far as I know, I'm the only one that sort of dedicated their professional life just to camel medicine now, yes.
Why camels, not birds or dogs or cats? Why camels?
I think it was a combination of where my interest met opportunity, and then it just went from there. So I'd been working as a mixed animal practitioner for about 20 years, and at the time was doing a lot of dairy cattle work, and the opportunity presented itself to me, and then I just became fascinated with the camel, how robust they are, how specifically designed they were to live in these difficult conditions, and then it just turned into a rabbit hole that I have fallen down happily.
Do you have your own camel clinic, Margie?
I guess I do. So because the way the camel industry works in Australia is that there is no one place where you can have a clinic. So it's me driving around to meet where the camels, where they are. So it's myself in a car, like a lot of vets do.
What's in the back of your car? If you've got a kind of a mobile camel clinic going on, what's in the back of your car?
That's right. It depends what's in the back, whether it's at the beginning or the end of the day, because you tend to collect a few different things during the day. But basically, it's like any sort of mixed practitioner's car. We've got everything from ultrasound to laboratory equipment, microscopes, surgical gear, some fun stuff like angle grinders.
Angle
ropes,
grinders?
Yes.
What do you use an angle grinder for?
Look, a vet and their power tools are often found together. Angle grinders, I mean, when you're dealing with large animals, certainly large animals like cattle or camels, you need large equipment. So angle grinders we actually use for cattle's feet. Unfortunately, when we have to do postmortems, we use angle grinders in postmortems and reticulating sores. There's almost like a small Bunnings floating around in the back of my...
Have you had to develop any of that equipment yourself, given that, you know, there aren't other camel vets that you can go and buy camel bits and pieces from?
Absolutely. And I think that was part of the intrigue to get into this in the first place, because the MacGyvering that's involved, if that's a verb, in making specific equipment for camels, I have found fascinating. So oftentimes I'll have to make sort of splints for camels. I'll make special bandages and special high heels for their feet if they're born with any foot abnormality. So you get very creative with a lot of different materials.
And I guess just the size of a camel relative to a human, you must be always having to stand on something to reach bits and pieces.
So I've got milk crates, I've got little ladders, I've got step boxes. I would prefer that I was maybe a foot taller. I think that would make my life a lot easier. but now I have to improvise, yes.
What first led you to camels?
I was in mixed practice and loved mixed practice vet work. In mixed practice, you sort of get to do everything. You could have a dog castration in the morning and then be doing a horse dental or a cesarean in the afternoon. So I was working in that area, and there were a lot of camels, well, camelids in this one particular area. A few people had pet camels, alpacas, and I really grew to love these things. They're a fascinating physiology, and they're really interesting to be around in terms of their personality. And so I did have a particular professional interest in that, and then I ended up meeting a gentleman who was a farmer, and he had some interest in camels, and
Where did you meet him?
Well, I was working at the ECCA.
Which is the royal show in Brisbane.
Yeah, kind of like our big royal show. It's really a big sort of highlight in the Queensland show calendar. So you've got this accumulation of all these amazing, beautiful breeds of animals, whether they are cattle to turkeys to goats, and they all sort of descend on Brisbane at that wonderful time of year in the ECCA, and they need a vet. You've got so many animals in a small area, something's potentially going to go wrong. And so as part of my work where I was for the university, we were contracted to be the vets for the ECCA.
And so do you have to stay out there around the clock, given all those animals are on site?
It's incredibly glamorous, Sarah. It's an amazing situation to be in. So, yes, we do actually have to stay with the animals.
So in what sort of setup?
Well, I'd like to say that, well, now it's slightly different. I think in the last year or so they've had accommodation off-site. But when I was there, it was accommodation on-site in a very small room, I should say cupboard, under a ramp that was right outside the animal wash bay.
Oh,
so
no.
In terms of being on call, it didn't get any better than that.
And what kind of things were you woken up to deal with in the middle of the night?
It was hilarious is, I think, the best way to describe it. Anything from someone bringing their dog with a poo sample, so a fecal sample, asking me if it had worms.
In the middle of the night?
At 2 a.m. And it's hard to be really polite and sweet when that's what you're given. But a lot of genuine emergencies. These are incredibly expensive animals with, you know, years and years of genetics put into these animals, and they've been shipped there, they're on different feed, and so anything can go wrong. Anything can pose a problem, and sometimes it went from surgery to, you know, bloats, general gastric problems, and then, of course, the high drama that can come with the ECCA as well.
So those dramas tend to be among the animal owners.
Always.
Rather than the animals. Which animal owners tended to be the most
dramatic? There's drama
dramatic.
Whenever people get together, I think, certainly when they're showing their prized animals. The animals I love, they don't care. They literally think they're on a holiday in Brisbane. They've never seen such green grass. They're being treated, they're being bathed twice a day. Everybody's caring for them. Kids are patting them. But the people is where the stress comes in. And anything from the conspiracy of the goat udder injections, someone saying that he was faking the size of his animal's udder by injecting, the conspiracy of he's put laxatives in my goat's feed. Not just the goat guys.
Yeah,
you know,
I've seen the goat owners. The goat owners are a red flag.
I didn't want to say that. I've alienated, you know, 5% of my clientele. But for some reason, the goats did cause a lot of issues.
So you were there working as a vet at the ECCA at the show, and you got talking to a farmer about camels. What was his idea?
Yeah, so the good part about the ECCA is obviously the other people at the ECCA are enjoying themselves. All the bars are open. I'm still going around doing my rounds. So you'd pop in for a drink. And I was chatting to this one gentleman, and I'm sure there were a few rums consumed before I had got to him, but he was telling me about this story that he had a great idea for utilising these camels for camel milk. And I said, oh, what a fabulous idea. And I believe I was the first person that had ever said that to him. And we struck up a conversation, and I offered my services in terms of, you know, if you ever need a hand with the camels, I've done a fair bit of work. And it went from there. It snowballed.
What took you out to Alice Springs early in your camel career, Margie?
Oh, that was such a wonderful experience. I was contacted by a fellow veterinarian in Alice Springs because they had this enormous bull camel. So the camel, male camels are still called bulls. And this huge camel needed to be castrated. The vet out there wasn't familiar in that procedure, so she called me, and I flew out there, and it was a bit Hollywood, actually, you know, being flown to somewhere. So I arrive at the property.
Very niche Hollywood
very
film.
Very niche Hollywood, I must admit. That is a very good point.
So you fly and you're driven out to meet this camel. What were your first impressions? What did this camel look like?
It was enormous. It was the most enormous creature I think I had ever seen. It was at least 9 foot. That was to probably just at its head. Its hump then went higher than that. It was literally movie-like, standing on the ground, staring then slowly staring skyward to try and reach to the top of this enormous creature. And
what
of course,
sort of weight?
I had to pretend that everything was fine. Sure, hi, how are you?
How heavy would something that?
It was over 1,000 kilos, so it would have been over a ton at least.
And you'd come to castrate it.
And I had to say, hi, I'm Margie. I'm here to take your testicles out. And everything's going to be okay.
And why did that camel need to be castrated?
So this particular camel, the male camels have a season. So they come into rut and they can get quite aggressive at that time. And so there had been some issues around this particular camel with other camels and some people. It had caused some dramas. And they finally worked out after quite a few years that it was probably best to castrate this camel. But there was a small problem in that it only had one descended testicle, which meant the other one was in there somewhere. So I then had to go about my business and perform, what, you know, my surgery.
What did you do? What's the first step?
So the first step is take a big, deep breath and then get all your medications ready. So with a lot of it, the animals might be different, but the principles are still the same. So you have to, you get all your anaesthetics ready. This is not something you can just do, you know, with hypnosis or anything. You need medication. So I got my anaesthetics ready, got an anaesthetic protocol, developed that for the size of the camel, and then had to problem solve. So get near the camel enough to give it an intravenous injection for the first part of the anaesthetic.
And is there a danger that a camel's going to kick you if it's aggressive and that size?
Always. And with camels, you've got to be really careful because they've got this ability to kick both front and back legs basically in a circle. So there's not one particular place where you are safe. So you really have to command the area and get a good relationship with the camel, if you can, whilst yielding a scalpel, and just work it out. So you work out with what you've got with the situation where you are. So I had a fence, I knew it was on one side, and then I would work at it from the other side of the fence. And it was, I wish I could talk it up as incredibly professional, but it was a bit of a running jump to just try and get this needle into a vein, which I did. And that took the shine off him a little bit and I could get a lot closer.
And then what happened? Once you've knocked the camel out, how did you go about finding that lost testicle?
Well, it sounds like a book. It's true. Even the act of knocking it out is difficult. These things, this is a 1,000-kilogram animal that was going from standing up to lying down, and they don't just sort of sit and then roll over. And so there's a lot of ropes. There's a lot of foam mattresses in place. And so it's quite the logistical nightmare. So,
and what about its hump? I mean, do you have to make space for that somehow?
Well, this is the interesting part. So I had worked out that it had one testicle, so I had to then go searching for the other one, which meant I had to lie it onto its back. And normally in surgery, that's, you know, standard practice. You hook ropes up to the animal's leg. We ended up hooking that onto a big ute, which then would roll the animal onto its back. But just before it sort of would get onto its back, I realised it's the hump. The hump. It can't lie on its back. It's got the hump. And so then, quick thinking, I then had to ask this particular farmer for a shovel. And I think he was a bit worried about what I was going to do with the shovel. But so then I had to dig a hole for the hump. That was all I could think of. You know, a lot of this surgery is out west and out in the bush and on the ground. So I had to then proceed to dig a hole and then line the camel up so much that when it was rolled into position, it just plopped into the hole.
And then
it
actually
went beautifully. I thought I had won the lotto when that happened.
And yes. Once it was positioned there, could you find what you needed to?
It did take a little searching. So I did have to go in to its abdomen and I went in, gloved up to a certain degree. Again, this is all bush vet stuff. So I'm going in there and I'd put my arm in and you feel is the testicle and the other anatomy around it. And sometimes I pulled out something and I have to look and go, well, that's not a testicle. And then I'd put it back in And then I'd go in again. But thankfully, it all went well. All the meantime I'm doing this, I also have to monitor the anaesthetic. And so I would have to sort of go from one end of the camel back to the other end to give it a top-up of anaesthetic and come back. It was utterly exhausting.
But the camel came through it?
The camel came
happily.
Through it just fine. And then I chose to do that particular one first, and there were another two camels to castrate. And the look on those camels after I had finished this first one was priceless, because then I had to turn around and go, hi, guys, you're next.
How did you look after performing that surgery on that camel?
I think the best way to describe that, I looked like I had been in a war zone. As I said, I was wearing gloves and protective gear, but there's a lot of things that go on. There's a lot of blood, sweat and tears in a camel castration, Sarah, and I had all of that on me. And whilst, as I said, I was wearing my surgical gloves, there was a lot of blood that had gone over my overalls and my arms at that point. But at the end, we were running out of light and we had to quickly go back.
And what did they make of you back at the hotel in Alice?
Well, that was when I checked in to the hotel in Alice straight off the camel castration. So I walked in and a very nonplussed gentleman behind the reception, and he was just going through routinely, this is what you need to sign, that, you know, do you need a key? And then I signed where I had to sign for the paperwork, and I left a big smear of blood across the paper. And then very apologetically, I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, I've just put blood all over the paperwork. And without even flinching, he literally said to me, don't worry, love, it's just Alice, you'll be right. I was terrified. I was utterly terrified. So I stayed in my hotel room overnight and I did not leave until the cab the next morning.
Nothing could have trained you or prepared you for camel castration like the one you've just described.
Correct.
But did you grow up around animals?
Not in any particular sense. And often people ask this of a lot of vets, I think. You know, did you always want to be a vet? Did you always love animals? I've definitely always loved animals. I grew up in Toowoomba, wasn't from a property. We always went out to friends' properties. I always loved hanging out with my animals. I mean, I do remember having a duck called Lucky who had a broken wing, and I remember her going to the vet once and the vet saying that she was stressed, and that caused my father to go into meltdown when he came home, because he'd just paid $85 to hear that a duck was stressed and he was working, looking after three children.
And you thought, this is the job for me.
And I thought, wow, there's something in this. No, I have always loved animals. It certainly wasn't something, I didn't grow up desperately wanting to be a vet, but I'm so glad I have, and it is the only thing I could ever imagine doing.
Once you did your training and started as a vet, who was your first patient?
Oh, wow. My first job, I was very fortunate to get a great job just outside of Brisbane in a town called Woodford. And I don't know whether it was an initiation process or whether it was a genuine call, but my very first job was to do a post-mortem on an ostrich. It was when ostrich farming was really big.
A post-mortem?
Yes, for insurance purposes. So they had to determine why this ostrich had died. And then they sent me out. It was literally my very first job. I had a brand new car. I was in clean, crisp, starched overalls. I looked about 12, and I drove out and met the farmer, and he looked me up and down. I'm sure he laughed. And then I said, hi, I'm here to look at the ostrich. The dead ostrich, and he said, it's over there. And I looked over and it was just a pile of mulch on the ground. And I went, oh, where is it? And he goes, oh, I buried it a couple of days ago.
Oh, you had to exhume it.
I had to exhume it. So he gave me a pitchfork. And so this was not part of the University of Queensland's pathology outline.
What
so I had to exhume the ostrich.
Is an ostrich in after it's been buried in mulch in Queensland for a couple of days?
Well, I mean, if I don't want people to be listening to this and feel sick, but liquefied would be the word that comes to mind.
Could you determine the cause of death?
No, I could not. I could not determine the cause of death, and I think that that caused him some drama. I think he really wanted something definitive, but it was very hard to determine with a handful of feathers and a leg.
You got a call about a turtle one night.
Oh my goodness!
Maggie, what was that?
Again, it's such a great job working as a vet because not every day is completely different from the day before. But I was on call. That's part of being a mixed practice veterinarian. And I got a call one night, it was probably about 10 o'clock, and the answered it very professionally, and this quite distressed woman on the other line said, I've got a turtle, I've got a sick turtle, and it's got something coming out of its bottom. And I thought it was my friends geeing me up for a complete joke. And so I said, oh, that sounds fantastic, and I hung up the phone. And then they rang again, and they said, no, I've just rang you. I'm sorry. I think the phone must have cut out. I've got a turtle. I think it's got a prolapsed rectum. And I, again, thinking it was my friend, thought, right, I'll have a bit of a joke here. So I said, right, what you've got to do is get the turtle, go outside. She's like, okay. I said, are you outside? Yes. I said, hold it above your head. Okay. And I could see, anyway, and turn around three times, and the gravity will then cause it to go back in. Because I literally at this point still thought it was my friends.
So terrible.
Isn't it? I feel terrible now.
It wasn't my friends. Did this poor woman do this with her turtle?
I believe so. I could hear movement on the other end of the phone. And then I said, and then call me back after half an hour. And she called me back after half an hour. And then I thought, oh, my goodness, I've just said that to like a paying, stressed client. And so I said, of course. She rang back and I worked out that this was just me. So I said, right, I'll meet you at the clinic straight away. So that was very weird because I was at probably about 11:45 on a Saturday night, putting back a prolapsed rectum in a turtle.
She was right.
She was absolutely right.
Turtle had had a prolapsed
rectum. And I had never been so serious in all my life when I met her at the clinic. I was incredibly professional. I felt so bad.
You went and spent some time working in the UK. Was it a very different setup over there? Were different sorts of animals, different sorts of clients?
Absolutely. And for vets working in the UK, it's almost considered a rite of passage, I think. It's the vets are treated differently over there. I think they're revered and, you're really part of a community. And I did some work in the north of England in Lancashire that had some language barriers. For me, definitely, which I was not expecting. I had no idea what people were asking me. I didn't even know how to greet people. Everybody kept asking me if I was all right. And then it took a while to work out that's just how they say hi. But then I also went down to Surrey, sort of outside London, and that's where some weird stuff happened. So there was one day a very punk man came in literally with an iguana on a leash into this tiny little practice that I was in, and everybody just seemed to treat it as normal, and I just had no idea what was going on. And there were a couple of animals that they would bring in, and I remember, they come in and they'd say, oh, this is my animal and she's feeling poorly, and I'd say, oh, it won't be a moment, and I went out the back to the nurse and I said, could you tell me what that is? Like, I literally had no idea what this animal was. And she goes, oh, it's a chinchilla. And I'm like, and what is that exactly? So it turns out I can't even remember. I believe it's a type of rodent. But then,
could you help once you'd been able to identify the creature?
Once she told me what group of animals it was in, I was able to go back to my first principles and give it some medication. But honestly, having to ask the vet nurse what animal this was definitely a low point professionally.
One of the things that people complain about with vets, Muggy, is the cost of care and diagnosis and then should it have to happen of burial.
Yes.
Why is it so expensive to go to a vet?
It's really interesting, and it's something that we have to deal with as vets every single day, and it's what everybody talks about, and I get it. I mean, you're not going to find a vet that's, cares about someone not being able to afford it or not. We work within whatever budget we have. But I think the big thing is that, we're providing a professional medical service for animals without any Medicare or PBS. So there is absolutely no you know, government funding or subsidies for anything that we do. And the overheads that we have as vets are so high. So you go to your vet in that one clinic, they're going to have state-of-the-art x-ray equipment, blood machines, anaesthetic machines, you know, endoscopes, ultrasounds. Some have CT scans and MRIs, and all of that's under the one roof, and all of that has to be paid for by that practitioner. There's no outsourcing. You don't go to a, you know, radiology clinic where they're taking on the costs of all of that. And I think people just with Medicare alone don't understand the cost of storing drugs, medications, even needles, syringes, disposables. And I get it, you know, as vets, we all understand that everyone has financial stresses. But it does grate you after a while having to constantly justify why you're doing this, you know, for the prices that you are when, you know, vets are trying to, it's a business for them as well. We're not Dr. Doolittle. We don't do it just for free.
I guess there's sometimes the assumption if you love the animal, you will do it for free.
And that's the trick that all vets fall into, because we've, you know, we're scientists. We've got scientific minds, but we've also got unbounding empathy as well. And so as soon as we get that call from somebody that's an animal's in distress or it's sick, the empathy kicks in way before the finance side of it.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Some of the things, Margie, after you had that conversation with the farmer at the Brisbane show and thought, yeah, all right, maybe camels are interesting, I want to discover more. What did you learn? I mean, how unique is a camel's anatomy? Is it completely different from other animals that you would have studied?
I find camels utterly fascinating. So they're in a group called camelids, and in that group that contains your alpacas, camels, llamas, a couple of other animals that are in mainly South America. So the whole group called camelids are just incredibly adapted and designed specifically for the environments that they live in. The anatomy is the same, you know, all the names are the same, but it's the way that they're put together and their physiology that is just remarkable, and they are just, they're a lesson in adaptation.
And do most camels have one hump or two?
Oh, great question. There's two types of camels. The dromedary camel has one hump, and the Bactrian camel, which is mainly in the northern hemisphere, sort of in the Mongolia area naturally, and they have two humps. And then, of course, a three-humped camel is just pregnant.
Oh, that's
Sorry.
Such a bad camel vet joke. That was... So what is in the hump? You know, I know that there are those cartoons of it being full of water, but I'm guessing that's not accurate. What's inside there?
That's right. So the hump, the whole idea of the hump is fat storage, and that's so these animals can go for long periods of time in really difficult country where there's not a lot of food, so they rely on that fat storage as a constant energy source. So it's pure fat that's in the hump.
And how long can a camel go without water then, if that's one of the things they're famous for?
And this is it, and it's a fascinating thing. It's not necessarily that they store water. A lot of people think that. Their blood cells are actually different. And what the idea is with the camels, their physiology is such that they can just handle dehydration. So in an area, in a time or a area where any other animal would be severely dehydrated and that would be causing problems with internal organs, the camel's physiology and red blood cells are such that they can just handle that dehydration, and they're the ultimate in water recycling.
And once they then have access to water, are they able to consume a lot quickly? Is that part of what works for
them?
They
can consume a lot quickly, you know, up to 20, sometimes 40 litres at a time. And even that alone can cause some physiological problems in other animals, but doesn't seem to in camels.
The stereotype of camels is that they're cranky. Is that true?
Well, Look,
I feel like I've just asked a parent who's got a difficult child and they love them, but they are a real nightmare.
They kind of can be. I have to tell you the truth. And the trouble is, with the stuff that I do to them, they've got every right to be cranky. They definitely will give you a warning though first. So camels are incredibly vocal, and they're very loud, and they will let you know if they're cranky before they do the characteristic spitting or
so they do kicking. Spit.
They do spit.
What's it feel like, Margie, to be spat on by a camel?
Well, I've got a lot of experience with this. Sadly, it's not actually a saliva. It's more, gastric fluid, which I think is actually worse than if it was just straight saliva.
So it's more like
saliva.
You're being vomited on.
A little bit, yes. And it's more like chewing tobacco. So it's a smell that once you're there, you're there. You're done for the day. Like if you get spat on early, that's it. Your day's done. But in saying that, I have not been, I would still be scared of an aggressive Maltese Terrier than I would be of getting spat on by a camel.
How intelligent are they?
Oh, well, it's always a subjective thing, isn't it? The intelligence of animals. But I think they're incredibly intuitive. I think they're intelligent. The way that they work together, the way that they can survive in the areas where they are, they're a very social animal. They rely on interconnection with each other. And then when you add people into that, they really do work you out pretty early, and they can really assess the situation a lot better than we think.
Are they a challenge to train, or are they like a horse in that they're kind of very responsive to training?
I believe that they're like a horse, that they're very responsive. There's some incredible people doing some great work with training camels in Australia, and it's a trust-based training system. So it's about gaining trust rather than trying to dominate the animal.
You mentioned the sounds that camels make.
Yes.
Can you work out what's being communicated? I mean, given how much time you spend around camels, do you pick up camel language?
I think so. I think certainly the people that work with them in the training situation, they would have a better idea of what those vocalizations are. Whenever I, as the vet, am involved, it's usually the noise, please could this weird lady get away from me? So I get quite an aggressive roar. I believe I've heard stories that the sound a camel makes is what George Lucas used in the Star Wars movies for Chewbacca. So it's that sound, but I've got to say it can get very, very loud.
How can you tell as the vet when a camel is ready to breed? What are the signs?
So the ages are a little bit different. They do wait until they're a lot older. In a male camel, it's fascinating. So the breeding cycle is determined by the male, different from pretty much every other species. So the male will come into season.
Right, so often it's a female that ovulates and that's when they're ready to breed, but
even
it's
more
the reverse
exciting.
In camels.
It's even more into that. So the male will come into season and breed, and then he will come into what's called, it's called a rut. So a lot of things get bigger. I'm sure everyone can work those out. So you've got the back end of the camel getting bigger, and then they have this gland on the top of their head which releases this black liquid substance when they're in the breeding season.
On the top of their head?
On the top of
Are
their head.
Are you making this up?
No, I wish, because I've also been smothered in that as well.
Well, what is it?
It's a gland that produces this oil, and the oil is it's part of, you know, creating and collecting females. The females find that dripping black substance down the back of their neck quite attractive. I've never fallen under that spell. But I think the most interesting part about the male camel or the bull camel is an out pouch of their soft palate called a doula. And it's kind of like this big flesh balloon that they project out of their mouth when they're in season, and that's another attractive thing for the females.
So
again,
these are signs to signal to a female that
yes,
the bull is ready.
That I'm keen, I'm ready, and look at the size of my doula. It's incredible.
And is it the cows who then choose a mate, or what, like, are females responsive all the time?
No, well, the females, they're what's called induced ovulators, and I find this one of the most fascinating parts about my work with camels. So because these camels are so perfectly adapted to conserving energy, and that even comes down to conserving the eggs. So they don't actually release an egg each cycle. They still have a cycle, but they will not release an egg like most other mammals will. Though when they're induced to ovulate is at time of mating. So basically they're incredibly efficient at only releasing an egg when they've been mated. Much like rabbits are also induced ovulators. So you can see how efficient a mechanism it is for reproduction.
So when that doula is ballooning and the black liquid is cascading and all other parts are protruding and the camel spends some special time together. Correct. How quickly can you tell when a camel's pregnant?
Wow, and this is the big trick. So in domestic or managed camels, these camels are trained to hoosh or sit down and we can put an ultrasound in. And with ultrasound diagnosis, we can tell that, I can tell that from sort of 20 days, whether they are pregnant, but you also have to know when they're mated. The problem that happens, and I have found, and as a big problem that we've had to problem solve in Australia, is that a lot of our camels are in that wild population. So we don't know when we get a collection of camels. We have no idea how pregnant they are, if they're pregnant. And so one of the things I've been involved in, it's been very exciting for me in the last year, is developing a preg test for camels. It's a blood pregnancy test for camels.
And is that working yet?
It's fantastic. Basically, you take a small amount of blood from the camel and they've got a very large jugular vein, so it's not difficult to do. And then within about 40 minutes, we can determine whether that animal is pregnant. And that saves me having to, try and preg test a camel in the traditional ways.
When did you first travel over and see camels on their home turf in the Middle East?
That was an opportunity that I was given a few years ago. One of the the camel queens in the world is working in Dubai. Australia also has another vet over in Dubai doing embryo transfer and artificial breeding programs with these camels in Dubai. And I had the opportunity to go and work with her in an incredible setup. I mean, it's an embryo transfer clinic.
In a designated or dedicated camel vet clinic?
Correct. In this particular one was just the reproductive part of a much bigger camel hospital. So entire specialist camel hospitals over there. I mean, it's a whole new world.
And how involved are owners in their camel care? Because these are animals that can fetch millions of dollars and are so prized. I mean, are owners around when you're checking on camels or even operating on them?
That's right. So the owners will often take... There's a bit of a hierarchy with the owners. There's the handlers, but the owners are always overseeing. So there's usually two handlers per camel, which is remarkable. So whenever the camel goes, there's two people that are going with it. And the owners take a very big observational role of what's happening. So in the camel hospitals, they have viewing platforms. So the owners of these camels worth millions of dollars will be operated on in the downstairs area. And
the camels will be operated on?
The camels are being operated on, whether it's, a tendon problem or a reproductive issue. And these owners are sitting up, having cups of coffee and tea, watching the animal get operated on.
How intimidating is that as a vet?
Too much pressure for me. I don't know if I could do it. I would be under way too much pressure, and you couldn't even make a quick joke.
What did they make of you as a female vet in Dubai?
I think that they were just they revere their camels so much, and they knew that I was there and I was able and trained to help their camel, and so. I must admit, I was expecting a bit of a gender issue, but I've got to say I had none. I was there to do a job, and they saw me definitely just as the vet rather than anything else. But I mean, I was definitely different.
The fact that you're a friendly and sociable sort of person, did that help, Margie, in breaking the ice with people?
Well, I thought I was super friendly, and I thought I was lots of icebreak and chatting and smiling and trying to be gregarious. But after a couple of days, I was told that that's not really kosher, and that a lot of working girls in the area have that as their as the way that they communicate. So I quickly shut my mouth and was quite grumpy from then on.
Don't smile so
much. Don't smile so much. No teeth. Don't show the teeth.
Did you attend any camel races while you were in Dubai? Oh,
amazing opportunity to attend a camel race. I'd heard about them and I thought, oh yeah, it'll be like a country race meet. And it was next level. It was like the Melbourne Cup on steroids. There were thousands of camels, thousands of people. And these camels are, the whole industry is designed around these racing camels.
And are people betting on them?
I don't believe they can bet.
Part of Islamic culture,
yeah,
is it?
In that culture. I don't believe they can bet, but they certainly can win a prize. I don't think there's any rule about winning a prize. So oftentimes a race, just one race, you would win a Land Cruiser, and there might be 12 races a day, and so all the Land Cruisers are lined up.
And what's different about the jockeys in camel races in Dubai?
I guess the fact that they're robots. So this I was not expecting. I mean, it's a welcome change in terms of occupational health and safety, because I believe they used to use small children. So they now use these robot jockeys, which...
I mean, are they shaped like people, or are they like little boxes?
Not at all. They're literally the shape of a drill, like an electric cordless drill. And then they've got a piece of plastic that comes out where the drill attachment would be. And that then just goes in a circular motion with remote control with the owners in the Land Cruisers on the inside of the track. Driving along the inside of the track with the camels at the same stage as the camels, and then when they're coming up to sort of around the last turn, they then use this remote control to start a whip on the camel.
Why do they use, I mean, I'm glad they're not using small children, but why robots?
It was purely because they needed some way to try and get the camels to, you know, keep moving.
And some lighter than a human.
Something expendable. And so these robots have now taken over, and it was incredible. At the end of the race, I remember looking at a ute that went past, and it was just filled with these little robots in the back, and I took a photo. It was amazing.
Oh, incredible. And if there are all the owners driving in their Land Cruisers alongside operating these robots, I mean, that must be its own sort of drama on the side. The humans racing must be part of the action.
Without question. And there's beeping, and it's really intense and dramatic. I was fortunate enough with my colleague to be in one of these Land Cruisers, and my mouth was agape all the time. It was the most remarkable experience, and the energy, and the camel races go for a long time. It's an endurance race. So, you know, the ones that we saw were 8 to 10 kilometres. So it's a long time.
And a camel can run at speed for that distance.
Yeah, they do pick up, and there's, you know, race tactics. But it's, I mean, they're endurance animals. They're built for it.
And not only endurance, but beauty. Tell me about the whole beauty industry connected with camels in the Middle East.
I've got to say, Sarah, this was a big eye-opener for me. I mean, I like camels, but this was the Miss Universe of camels. The beauty camel industry is a $1 billion industry over there, and they have, it's literally the most beautiful camel. It's a cultural experience for them.
And what kind of qualities make a camel beautiful?
Well, hump size, obviously, and then everything from their lip size, the colour of the camel, the length of the eyelashes.
And so what are people doing to enhance their chances of winning a camel beauty pageant?
The same that they do in enhancing their chance in a human beauty pageant. So prosthetics, I'm talking Botox and eyelash extensions and facial surgery to reduce wrinkles.
To reduce camel wrinkles?
Yeah, they will do a facelift on a camel.
You weren't doing any of this.
No, I did not. But I had to listen with a straight face, listening to a vet that was telling me about his facelift procedure.
Back here in Australia, the situation with camels is different, to say the least. When did camels first start arriving in Australia?
So the first group of camels came to Australia to be used as workhorses, or work camels on to make the Ghan Railway, sort of up in the middle of Australia. They had to get these animals carrying loads out into the desert and a long time between water points. So a bright spark decided that camels were a really good option and brought the first camels over, I believe, in about the 1820s.
And what happened with those animals then after the railway was completed?
Yeah, they you know, people grew to love them because they also came with their minders from Pakistan, and there was a big group of people and they were very well loved. But at the end, they just couldn't really work out what to do. So they let them go. They just let them go. And that now gives us our, you know, feral camel population in Australia.
And how significant is the feral population here?
There's some numbers that say up to, you know, millions of camels, but as you can understand, it's very difficult to get really good ideas and of these numbers. They're hard to track, and, you know, it's very hard to count all these camels out west.
And what sort of damage do feral camels do in the outback?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in terms of damage, the whole idea is that they don't cause a lot of damage if they're managed properly. But if they're competing with cattle in these areas, they are going to compete for water and food sources. So a lot of people say that, you know, and there's been in the media lately that there is a lot of damage.
Do their hooves cause damage the way that cows and sheep?
They don't even have hooves.
They don't have hooves?
No, they don't have hooves. They're a non-hooved animal, and this is one of their...
What happens at the end of their feet? So they're wearing little sneakers.
So they've actually got these fat pads that they walk on, and it's protective against the sands of the deserts when they can get up to over 65 degrees in heat. So these big fat pads sort of insulate. But then, of course, they have their toes. So they've literally got toenails, and they walk on a fat pad, so it's not even a hoof.
So they're not causing damage to the soil the way that other imported animals
do. That's right. It's a soft-hooved animal. So they're said to not cause as much erosion to those sort of fragile soils that we have out west.
So it's more a competition with existing agriculture.
Correct.
So there are some farmers who are hoping to see or already seeing camels as a source of income. What kind of things are camels being farmed for in Australia?
Well, I think the camel is one of the most underutilised resources. There are production animal, the perfect production animal, really, when you think about it. So they're beautifully adapted to these marginal countries, and a lot of farmers are now seeing it as an opportunity for perhaps a protein industry in areas where we've been trying to graze cattle in these areas that may not really be well designed for these particularly marginal arid areas. The camels are thriving.
So protein, so that's meat.
That's the meat.
What's the market for camel meat? I mean, I can't imagine there's a big one here. Would it be more an export?
It is more of an export market. And so the more awareness we get of that, and the more there is a worldwide need for protein, I believe it's an untapped resource.
What's the tastiest part of a camel?
It's like anything. You've got that sort of one really good cut at the back, so that sort of eye fillet, and that would be the best part. The closer you go to the hump, the higher the marbling score. So you can actually get meat marbled at a 9 marble score, which I believe is very good.
So do people eat the hump in cultures that traditionally eat camel?
I think so. I would see the hump as being more of a rendered product and you know, finding a use for that oil there. But I believe that there are definitely areas in the world where camel is considered a delicacy.
What about using camel for dairy here? Is that happening?
Yeah, these are some of a lot of my clients are dairy, you know, camel dairy farmers. So what they're doing is they're taking this camel that naturally produces milk and using it as an alternative dairy source. You know, there's definitely some differences in camel milk from cow's milk. The other interesting thing a slight difference, but certainly I can't actually tell the difference, but I'm no foodie. I believe it's lower in lactose, which is great. You can actually consume it if you're lactose intolerant. And there's got that's sort of a great market for the camels there. And another side from sort of the animal welfare side of things is that the cow camels, the ones making the milk, will only produce that milk with their camel calf around them. So it's not like in other industries where calves are taken away. This one, it's a cow calf unit that produces your milk.
And Is it hard to milk a camel? Have you ever tried milking a camel?
Look, another thing to add to my ever-expanding resume, I have milked a camel, correct, but they're now using automated milking machines. It is difficult to milk them. Remember, these camels haven't been genetically designed or genetically engineered.
Selected
for milking. So there is a training process because we're getting these feral camels into a training process. The reality is, though, you know, within a very short period of time, months, these animals will stand happily with their calf on the other side. They take some milk and the calf gets the rest.
And those four kicking legs that you mentioned?
Yeah, that's another tricky one. This is probably why I haven't gone specifically myself into milking camels. But once the camel's milking, the oxytocin is released and they do sit quite happily. But always be worried about the legs.
Beyond uses of camels for meat and for dairy, what kind of uses can you imagine happening here in Australia, particularly with climate change and drought conditions? Like how can, given that we're having to think of different ways of using our land, how might camels play a role for farmers in transforming the way they use land?
I've been really interested in this probably for the last few years because of these really marginalised areas, certainly in outback Western Queensland. I've seen a real benefit to utilising the camel as a grazing animal. So there's large areas of mulga in some areas of Western Queensland that, you know, the government are paying levies to not knock down the mulga. So we're trying to keep carbon credits alive. So by maintaining the trees, you're increasing the carbon that we are holding in our environment. So the trouble is with cattle and sheep and goats is that the only way that they can eat these mulga trees, which are a great source of feed, is if you knock the tree down. Now, the government's trying to promote people not to knock these trees down. And guess who's tall enough to eat the top of a mulga tree? And that's a camel. So you can actually co-graze camel and cattles, and they actually work really well together. There's a thing called transformation. So there's the bacteria in a camel's stomach, which are really good at digesting these thick twigs and harsh vegetation. They can transfer over to the cattle and make them more efficient at eating higher fibre material.
How do they transfer their bacteria?
Within the faeces that's on the ground and also mainly within the water trough. So if you share a water trough with a camel, and if you're a cow, I wouldn't recommend it if you're a person, but if
people
you're
are really interested in gut health now.
I know, gut health,
you know,
is big.
Forget kombucha, I'm going to share a water trough with a camel.
I think I'd prefer that than drinking kombucha myself. But yeah, the transformation occurs at the water points, and it's a fabulous way to get the best out of really tough marginal country.
Margie, it has been a fascinating education to speak with you about camels today. I have many visual pictures that I'm just going to take with me for a long time, I think. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.